My fellow Americans and all those listening overseas, welcome back to Visiting the Presidents. I'm your host, Jeff Akash, and today we are on our road back to Quincy, Massachusetts, and the crypt at the Church of the Presidents and the gravesite of John Quincy Adams, 6th President of the United States. Now, before we go too far, I always want to remind you to be checking out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to the associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on the social media profiles at Visiting the Presidents on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where I provide additional content throughout the week. Liking and commenting helps to raise the profile, and I appreciate any of you who've written a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You'll also find a link to help support Visiting the Presidents through PayPal. Your support helps to fund the production, editing, and hosting of Visiting the Presidents episodes and the website, as well as future trips and books. All support is greatly appreciated, but at the top of Mount Rushmore of giving is Sammy and Tom Fakash, Nancy and Terry Wehrkamp, Debbie and Dennis Fakash, Harvey and Casey Hyman, Connie and Adam Locke, Brittany and Keith Mellon, Stephanie Gaskill, and Andrew Alexander. Also, Jim and Catherine Hyman, Gail Rittenhouse, Sean and Liz Jones, Stephen Gilroy, Kurt Dion, Alexis Mira, April McKenzie, Megan Hochstetler, Caitlin Cahalan, Jim and Laurel Brayler, Eric Engartner, Patricia Argentina, Kara Steiner, Jamie and Ted Wilson, Candy and Ben Phelps, Lana Demers and Craig Hunter, Kenneth Robinson, Thomas Kalina, Kristen and Steve Wendell, and Alex Syker. Thank you all so much. And just as a note, when my parents were visiting over spring break, my mom was kind of surprised that I do my own editing of the episodes. And so if you're under the impression that I send this out somewhere where they do all of the editing, no, I have to listen to all of it and do all of the editing myself. So I did want to dispel that. So all of the production that you're hearing, it is just me. It is a one-person operation. So yeah, if that helps in your giving, so be it. Now, I also want to recommend that you go back and listen to the previous season's episodes on each president. For John Quincy Adams and his birthplace, his childhood, check out John Quincy Adams and Braintree/Quincy. And then for season two, you'll want to check out John Quincy and Peacefield, where we go to the home that he shared with his father after his parents passed. Now, where we had left off with John Quincy Adams, his presidency was effectively neutered from the moment he took office, with General Andrew Jackson's supporters determined not to give him a fair shake, particularly after what they had viewed as a corrupt bargain between Adams and his new Secretary of State, Henry Clay. The Democrats, as Jackson's partisans started to call themselves, lined up to criticize the Tariff of 1828 as the so-called Tariff of Abominations, as the federal government meddling unnecessarily in the finances of citizens. The Democrats were already deep into their campaign against Adams, with the Tennessee legislature announcing their support of Andrew Jackson's 1828 bid in 1825, 3 years before the election, so the writing is on the wall. Adams' re-election will be doomed from the start, and 1828 is a torturous year for John Quincy Adams. While James Monroe is often viewed as the last of the founding presidents, I think John Quincy truly is, because he is so similar to the way his father thought of himself politically and what the office really should be. Like his father, John Quincy believed that his record and resume spoke for itself and did not need him trumpeting or having other people rally to his way of thinking. It was clear to him. And so in so many ways, he thought he was kind of owed the office by dint of his service. And then once attained, it has to have been very dispiriting to have the time that he spends in the White House be so miserable. Throughout the upcoming election, Adams supporters had warned off the Jackson election, portraying Andrew Jackson as a polygamist, as a murderer, and adding animosity to the political differences that existed between the two men. They started off on a great foot, most famously with John Quincy hosting a very large ball for Jackson shortly before the 1824 election. They shook hands. Andrew Jackson seemed almost buoyant. But then that so-called corrupt bargain will change everything. And then the slanderous accusations from Adams' supporters will only seal the deal for Jackson's hatred. And like I said, John Quincy is very much like his dad, believing that it's beneath him to campaign or defend his actions in any manner that would be considered politicking. But this leaves him at a huge disadvantage when his opponents focus so heavily on distorting his record. John Quincy will be very embarrassed when he suffers an accident where he is rowing across the river. He liked to go walk every day, but swim when it's nice out. And so he would row across the river and then kind of swim back. But he gets sent in before before he's ready and is going to have to swim about 3 miles in the water before he can get to safe harbor. And the Democrats just make fun of him. And then at the same time, they're calling him a pompous individual. And so it's like, well, which is he, right? There's also this rumor that they start where they say that John Quincy went to church barefoot. That one just cracks me up. Like, his wife takes that one so seriously. But again, how do you combat those kinds of rumors, right? John Quincy also is our first president to have Congress controlled completely by the party in direct opposition to him. Now, presidents after him, and you know, when we look at current Congress and our most recent presidencies, we're used to that, but that would have been very bewildering to John Quincy Adams. He becomes very depressed at his fate and will mope around the executive mansion. He does get up every day at around 4:15 a.m. He writes for a couple hours, does these Bible sessions, and then will walk to the Capitol and back, or go into Georgetown and back. And then, like I said, when it's warm out, he'll go swimming in the Potomac, which, remember, the Potomac is much closer to the White House back in this day than it is today. He also really gets into horseback riding, but not for the reasons that Thomas Jefferson or James Madison might have, but he does it for his own kind of edification. And then he also is noticed to be losing weight pretty rapidly. So gives you a good sense into what we would consider depression, but they didn't call it that at the time. For a time, John Quincy will stop writing in his diary, which is almost unheard of when this man would write almost every day of his life. But he's unable to make any sense of kind of where he had went wrong. He cannot resolve that with himself. And it's hard for him to live with the hatred that's being kind of heaped on him. His afternoons will be spent with official business, meetings, reading documents, but he'll also say, like, in the evening that he's super bored, writing, quote, "I visit my garden, make trivial observations upon the vegetation of trees until dark, and then, quote, a repose of torpid inaction for around 2 hours before then going to sleep." And so, again, I think we get insight into how this man is dealing with what we would consider to be depression. Famously, John Quincy also loses his father while in office, his father who had been the president of the United States, and will have received word in July of 1826 that his father's health is failing. So he's on his way back to Quincy when he's stopping in Baltimore and receives word that his father has actually passed. By the time he arrived, his father had been buried. Going to a service at his parents' church and viewing their empty pew moved John Quincy to tears. It's the first time he'll break down, and then it will actually lead him to join the church for himself. As much as he was a man of faith, he never took the action to formally join the church until then. If John Quincy is miserable throughout his presidency, his wife, Louisa, is even more unhappy. She followed Elizabeth Monroe's example and limited her opportunities to entertain or be available, but she's also battling ill health, including a skin condition called erysipelas, or St. Anthony's fire, a strep infection that will result in fever, headaches, and skin inflammation. Louisa and John Quincy will also have become emotionally distant, with Louisa increasingly critical of the cost of John Quincy's political career, weighed against how unhappy they both are. For a time, they became physically distant when they spent a summer with John Quincy going back to Quincy to kind of deal with the house situation of his parents, and Louisa saying, "I'm going to go to the Hudson Valley in New Hampshire by myself." Still, Charles Francis will write about how well his mother complimented his father's talents, including being really sensitive to the criticism against him. And that's where I got that story about him going barefoot to church. She said, "You need to put wool in your ears and stop reading the paper." Great advice. Just great advice. Now, the Adamses do leave their mark on the executive mansion with the billiards room, John Quincy's favorite pastime. He wrote that he loved playing billiards at the end of the day, but then would inevitably berate himself for wasting time on games. He'll be very distressed when, of course, the Democrats pick up on this and will make it a political issue, terming his billiard playing as gambling. He also will take up gardening, as I said, with Adams spending an hour before or after dinner in the gardens and even developing a nursery for fruit trees at the executive mansion. Now, few presidents will have had as prolific a second life as John Quincy Adams, which would see him return to political power in a distinguished post-presidency that will last 19 years. But it began inauspiciously, with John Quincy bitterly resentful of his electoral defeat and even refusing to attend Andrew Jackson's inauguration, just like his father had done. President-elect Jackson had offered the Adamses to take their time packing up and that he would find other lodging in Washington. as Adamses had done for the Monroes, you'll remember. But then he changed his mind and sent word to the Adamses that he wanted an Inauguration Day party in the executive mansion. This would be the party that would later become legend, with so many well-wishers showing up that a window had to be broken to help Andrew Jackson escape. Adams reacted very poorly and sends word like, I'll be out of there, don't worry about me. And he's out of there on March the 3rd, spending the time at the end of his term running errands around Washington, D.C. The Adamses moved to Meridian Hill, that's about 2 miles from the Capitol building, and today is where there's a public park. And then we'll head home to Peacefield, where John Quincy had inherited. Now, he was nervous about living at his parents' home and what it could do to him emotionally and what it would be like to go back there, but it drew him closer to their memory, and he'll be saddened to find that the home was in somewhat disrepair at the hands of his son, George, and then a lot of the John Adams heirs who had come through to pick through the various furniture. John Quincy will set about putting the house back together again and will even make some alterations, including a hallway that will link the two wings of the home. And you can listen back to either season 2, episode 2 or season 2, episode 6 of that home at Peacefield. John Quincy was quietly offered the job of president of Harvard College when he showed back up, but he'll beg off saying that he's just too broken down. And like his father and Thomas Jefferson, however, John Quincy will be dealt an enormous personal blow when his son, George Washington, goes missing. John Quincy and Louisa were actually waiting for George to come and accompany them back to Peacefield. And then they find word that his body was washed ashore off of Long Island. It's believed that George Washington Adams had committed suicide, but was also the long result of his alcoholism. Adams wrote in his diary, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Clearly feeling personally and professionally abandoned in that moment. Adams would lose another son, John Adams II, just a few years later. And it will harken back, I think, to season 1, episode 2, when we talked about John Adams and his own upbringing. And then when we talked about his parenting style. But it's clear that both President Adams made their expectations clear for their sons, and it did result in some success for both John and John Quincy to have a son like John Quincy and Charles Francis. But then it also has the horrific consequences for both of John Quincy's brothers, who also die of alcoholism at a young age, and then John Quincy's own 2 sons, who the same thing will happen. Louisa chooses to remain in Washington after her son dies, choosing not to be around John Quincy in that moment that he's so moody and probably is somewhat blaming him. There's also the fact that John Quincy's drunkard layabout brother is at Peacefield hanging around as well. By the end of the summer, surprisingly, John Quincy decides he's going to move back to Washington, our first president to choose to stay in the nation's capital after his term ended, and they buy a home on F Street near where the FBI is headquartered today. John Quincy spent his days wandering on the Potomac River, planting his beloved fruit trees and reading both the Bible and then Cicero. He'll even in this time start a biography of his father, using the time to rummage around in John Adams's papers and his own childhood effects. Now, Adams very much resembled his father in thinking that his life had been finished once he had been defeated as president, but we know that there's going to be a huge post-presidency ahead of him, and to his great surprise, the people of Quincy will nominate him to the U.S. House in a district that was just created to be kind of gerrymandered from Plymouth as its center, and he'll be nominated as an anti-Mason. Initially, Adams was fairly reluctant. He felt that he couldn't refuse the call necessarily, but he again thought his days were numbered. And Louisa and Charles will weigh in and say, this is not something that will be of your interest. John Quincy, however, will be elected, and he'll be going back to the Congress, where he will serve as a thorn in Andrew Jackson's side. He'll eventually join the Whig Party and serve for the next 17 years, and even die in that chamber, as we'll talk about. Of course, in this, John Quincy stands alone, our only former president to return to the House of Representatives. Andrew Johnson will return to the Senate, and of course, you're familiar that William Howard Taft will return to the Supreme Court. And we will talk in the 20th century how it's much more common for the presidents to remain in the public eye or in public service, but in different capacities. But John Quincy is still to this day the only president to go back to the House. The Adamses stayed in that house on F Street throughout his congressional session, and then he'd leave for Quincy over the summer break or any extended periods, but that took about a week to get there. As you might guess, John Quincy was dedicated to the job, insisting on attending literally every session. This left Louisa even more alienated, as his role did not require the kind of entertaining that his previous posts had. He has no ability to kind of disengage from his work. Louisa will take up poetry and even fishing, but then will be enormously grateful to have grandchildren who she can throw her heart into, including John Quincy Adams II, their first grandson. After John Adams II died in 1834, John Quincy will stop by his house every day for years to help his granddaughter with her arithmetic, which I thought was just an adorable story. And then he'll take care of the family financially. So like John, he does not have the enormous burdens of the kind of land problems that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe all had, but he's going to have to take care of extended family. Like his predecessors, he'll then accumulate massive debts owing to maintaining two homes, right? And then having to care for all this family. This will lead to him selling his books and then even taking loans from a former servant who became a popular tavern keeper in Washington. Throughout his time in Congress, Adams was mainly in opposition to the majority, supporting the Bank of the United States as Andrew Jackson went against it, opposing the annexation of Texas as the Democrats were pushing for that move, and then going head-to-head over James Polk's declaration of war versus Mexico. Adams is best known in Congress, however, for finding a strong voice against the extension of slavery, introducing bills from Pennsylvania Quakers on his very first day in Congress, and then never letting up until the day he dies. Literally. Adams's biographer Paul Nagel thought that Adams was motivated as much by his hatred of his Southern colleagues, who he never forgave for attacking him in 1828, as for his evolving feelings on slavery, where he was mostly ambivalent on the topic before he joined the House. Notably, however, Adams did not count himself to be an abolitionist, and so we'll say there is a clear distinction between what he wants and what their interests are. He is so quick-witted and takes so much pleasure as he develops this reputation for his denunciations of his critics, including President Jackson, that this is where he earns that nickname, Old Man Eloquent. Jackson, in turn, will see Adams as, quote, the most demented, reckless, and depraved man ever living, or he calls him the madman from Massachusetts. And I think, again, those are both great. And he says that Adams belongs in a hospital. Adams entertained an opportunity to go into the Senate and even briefly ran for governor of Massachusetts before withdrawing, and the House will be where he belonged and where his talents were probably best used. One of the most famous of his victories will be against the gag order, which was installed by Democrats to table any petitions without debate that were critical of slavery in an effort to keep the peace with any anti-South Carolina congressmen who were looking for opportunities to entertain secession or nullification. When Adams will shoot to his feet to declaim Democrats on the topic of slavery, he'll be ignored or overruled, and that will lead Adams to do these series of protests. Adams will read into the record any anti-slavery petitions, any articles people will send him from around the country, trying to humiliate the speaker, and then leading to Democrats screaming every day for him to be expelled or to be shut up whenever he rises to speak. They even introduce a vote to censure him. The House will eventually rescind the gag rule in 1844, and that's considered one of his big triumphs. Now, you're likely familiar also that John Quincy will famously argue before the Supreme Court in 1841 in support of the African mutineers on board the Amistad, which will later be made into the film of the same name, dramatizing those events, and he will be portrayed by Anthony Hopkins. Adams became an outspoken advocate for stopping the spread of slavery, and so that will lead for him to be the leading candidate to try before the court. But Adams begs off, saying, I haven't really had to do this since the early 1800s. He'll write in his diary that his double duty in service to the Congress and in arguing before the Supreme Court was physically draining. And he sounded a lot like his father when he wrote, my eyes are threatening to fail me. My hands tremble like an aspen leaf. My memory daily deserts me. My imagination is fallen into the sere and yellow leaf, and my judgment sinking into dotage. Instead, he'll be elated when he's victorious and the mutineers will be allowed to return to Africa. This renewed his energy for Congress, and he'll receive a lot of hate mail for the trouble, but then will be greeted everywhere he goes by people who come up to him in the streets of Quincy or when he's walking around Washington, just wanting to shake his hand and get to talk to him. And so it's a kind of full circle moment for John Quincy Adams, and it had to have felt good after how low he felt going into his retirement. By the 1840s, Adams was respected by members from both major parties, given the same spot in the House chamber for most of his term, right to the left and then close to the Speaker's chair. And Adams will remain at his desk for the hours that the House is in session. When he's not holding court, he'll be found at his desk just reading and writing. It's where he lived, right? He has no other office, so he's just going to hang out there. And while he's respected by the House members from both parties, he'll also become deeply despised on his views on slavery as they become more vociferous, including having a man come up and want to hit him in the face, and that is stopped right in its tracks. He'll be gratified to deliver the eulogy for his old boss, James Monroe, in 1831, as we had mentioned in the last episode. And then in 1836 is called upon to give a eulogy for James Madison, which he used mainly as an opportunity to unload on Thomas Jefferson. But Adams has no use for any of the presidents who are alive while he's in Congress. He hates President Jackson and Vice President Van Buren, rebuffing any attempts by the future Vice President Richard Johnson to broker peace over a potential dinner with Adams and Jackson. When Harvard's president and John Quincy's cousin, Josiah Quincy, personally asks Adams to attend a ceremony where they were going to present an honorary degree to President Jackson, Adams took the opportunity to trash Andrew Jackson. Quote, "As myself an affectionate child of my alma mater, I would not be present to witness her disgrace in presenting her highest literary honors upon a barbarian who could not write a sentence of grammar and hardly could spell his own name." When Andrew Jackson dies a decade later, Adams wrote that he was, quote, "a hero, a murderer, and an adulterer, who in his last days of his life belied and slandered me before the world and died." When he heard reports that Jackson was dying in prayer, Adams could only compare him as the fraudster at the center of Molière's Tartuffe. Adams was friendly with William Henry Harrison, who he had appointed to be the Minister of Columbia, and he attended dinners at the Executive Mansion where he was offered the opportunity to give the first toast to the new president, but he will be horrified when William Henry Harrison dies and then is going to be replaced by John Tyler, and will not be friendly with either Tyler or James Polk. John Quincy will be among the House members who are opposed to Tyler seizing that office after Harrison's death, and his eloquence in denouncing presidents remained intact when they asked him to go to a ceremony dedicating the monument at Bunker Hill. Remember, that's a battle that he had witnessed as a 7-year-old with his mother. But he'll find out that President Tyler will be there too and will say, quote, "How could I have witnessed this without an unbecoming burst of indignation or of laughter? John Tyler is a slavemonger. With the association of the thundering cannon, which I heard, and the smoking of the burning Charleston, which I saw on that awful day, combined with this pyramid of Quincy granite and John Tyler's nose, with a shadow outstretching that of the monumental column, instead stayed home and visited my seedling trees and heard the cannonades rather than watch the president at dinner at Faneuil Hall swill like swine and grunt about the rights of man." Think he really took his time when it came to making insults for these presidents. Adams remained abreast of science and innovation among the group that watched as the new telegraph was demonstrated at the Capitol building, and one of the chief proponents of shepherding James Smithson's endowment, which will create the Smithsonian Institution. Adams was excited to travel to Cincinnati to dedicate an observatory and was greeted by well-wishers throughout his route, a full-circle moment after his own urgings for observatories was ridiculed when he served as president by those Democrats in opposition. When Neptune was discovered, Adams will be delighted, and he'll begin visiting Harvard's observatory just to check it out pretty regularly. Adams also loved to write poetry and would give these long, detailed essays analyzing Shakespearean plays or Cicero or the Bible. And again, his mind was just always going. He composed a poem just weeks before he died in his really kind of trembling hand, but he was just always, that mind was always going. Now, in turning to his death, throughout most of his adulthood, John Quincy Adams enjoyed good health, but was also very rigorous about his exercise. Like we said, he woke up early in the morning to go for his long walks, about 4 miles, and he would swim as late as his 80th year. He noticed he was almost always congested after about the age of 60, that he could just never shake that congestion, and some of you might be able to relate, and that by the time he was president, he also had very watery eyes. Like he always looked like, not he was crying, but that he had just like a watery buildup. As president, he also started to experience frequent painful headaches. And again, I have to believe a lot of that could have been stress. In November of 1844, he suffered physical exhaustion after his trip to Cincinnati, which left him, quote, nearly helpless and forced to lay on a couch for days with his, quote, graveyard cough. His doctors gave him a variety of, as he called it, slops and drops, pills and paste, lotions and potions. But Louisa will boil snake root and say that that might work. And then John Quincy will eat horsehound candy. Again, they tried everything back then, right? John Quincy feared all the remedies and what they did for his mind and memory. And in the summer of 1845, he'll have had a huge fall, one while he's just out walking and another when he's trying to get off a train and he falls about 4 feet to the ground. And so he's starting to fall more frequently and just having a harder time recovering. In November of 1846, John Quincy was strolling around Boston with a friend when his legs buckle from under him and he drops to the ground, having suffered a stroke. He was bedridden for weeks, and though he recuperates and returns to Washington to resume his congressional term, he'll be greeted by a standing ovation on the House floor when he returns. But in his diary, Adams will list that everything after that stroke was a posthumous memoir. From that hour, I date my decease and consider myself for every useful purpose to myself and fellow creatures dead. In late 1847, Adams clearly was beginning to flag, with Louisa and Charles intervening to convince him to back off all of his committee work. And though he'll still attend every session of Congress, he will be driven to the Capitol building on a horse and buggy rather than walking it himself. He had to give up his daily diary writings in December and then is unable to attend the Washington Monument cornerstone laying. He had inconsistent sleep patterns and sometimes turned to sleep aids, with doctors experimenting with battery shocks, which I thought was crazy, but Adams said he noticed no difference. On February 21st, 1848, the House was voting to decorate generals from the Mexican-American War. Adams will stand up loudly and shout, "No!" And a few minutes later, he'll stand to address the speaker, but instead will slump over at his desk into the arms of his neighbor, suffering a second and this time massive stroke. "Mr. Adams is dying, Mr. Adams is dying," was heard throughout the chamber, and his fellow congressmen carried him to the front of the House floor after they put ice water on his face. They bring in a sofa, and Adams will be placed on that and carried to the rotunda of the Capitol near a window, but it will be considered to be too cold, and so they remove him to the speaker's office just off the rotunda. There he'll be attended by four different doctors who are also congressmen, and they noted his entire right side was now paralyzed. Adams called for Henry Clay, his old Secretary of State, who came in to clasp hands but was unable to speak at the sight of his dear friend. The doctors tried bleeding Adams as well as leeching and then cupping and then putting mustard plasters all over his body in the same way that we talked about with earlier treatments of, for instance, George Washington. His wife and a niece and nephew were brought in, but they will recognize immediately how bad their condition is. John Quincy will know it himself and will say, quote, "This is the end of earth, but I am composed," or "I am content." Those are his last words. He'll fall into a coma and then not awaken for his final 2 days, finally dying on February 23rd, 1848 at around 7:20 at night, the only president to die in the Capitol building at the age of 80 years old. He's our eighth president to die, but only our second to die in Washington, D.C. John Quincy Adams's body was laid in a House committee room in a service arranged by his fellow congressmen, including Abraham Lincoln from Illinois. He'll be placed in a coffin there. Daniel Webster will write the plaque, and it's ironic. John Quincy hated Daniel Webster, but he'll write, "John Quincy Adams, born an inhabitant of Massachusetts, July the 11th, 1767, died a citizen of the United States in the capital of Washington, February 23rd, 1848, having served his country for half a century and enjoyed its highest honors." I did find from James Polk's proclamation of John Quincy Adams's death, where he wrote, "It has pleased divine providence to call hence a great and patriotic citizen. John Quincy Adams is no more. At the advanced age of more than 80 years, he was suddenly stricken from his seat in the House of Representatives by the hand of disease on the 21st and expired in the Capitol a few minutes after 7 o'clock on the evening of the 23rd of February, 1848. He had, for more than half a century, filled the most important public stations, and among them, the President of the United States. The two houses of Congress, of one of which he was a venerable and most distinguished member, will doubtless prescribe appropriate ceremonies to be observed as a mark of respect for the memory of that eminent citizen. Just thought that was a very kind of beautiful way to summarize John Quincy Adams' life from somebody who wasn't the biggest fan of him politically. And then I also found where Charles Francis, when he finally reached his father, he had been away on business, and he gets the word when he's on a train that his dad has died by reading in the paper. And so when he showed up, they had already put him in a lead-lined, partially windowed coffin with a glass plate that allowed for people to kind of look in on his death and maybe to get rid of that fear of being buried prematurely. Mourners file by for the next 2 days in that committee room, and then on February 25th, a cannon will be fired early in the morning in Washington, D.C., and then every minute until noon, which again just has to feel like overkill. The service will begin then at noon, being held in the House chamber, with his casket at the Speaker's rostrum and the room entirely draped in black, including his empty chair. Members of the House, Senate, Supreme Court, and President James Polk and Vice President George Dulles will both be present. John Quincy Adams' casket was processed then to the Congressional Cemetery in Washington before a crowd of 15,000, and his hearse was pulled by the same horses that had been used for William Henry Harrison's funeral 7 years before. Adams was placed into a receiving vault at Congressional Cemetery, again the same one used by President Harrison, and we'll talk about this in Episode 9, for a few days before departing for Boston on March the 5th with a delegation of family and House colleagues, one representing each state. When his body arrives in Boston 5 days later, Adams's coffin will be driven around Boston, ending at Faneuil Hall, where there is a larger memorial service. His casket will then be taken to Quincy, where he's first moved to the Peacefield Mansion, and then is taken from there to United First Parish Church, where there will be another funeral service. He was then moved to the receiving vault at Hancock Cemetery across the street. In his will, John Quincy left his library and personal papers, as well as his home at Peacefield, to his son Charles Francis, and other properties to be divided among his wife, daughter-in-law, granddaughter, and son. John Quincy Adams' casket was, as I said, moved to the family vault, and that was intended to be his permanent resting place. You'll recall in Episode 2 where they had put John Adams temporarily there, but then John Quincy's sister and then his two sons were there as well. In this case, however, John Quincy's name will be engraved across the top of that vault. His other son, Charles Francis, will think that the two presidents should be buried together, and so he makes plans to enlarge the crypt and build a matching pair of sarcophagi for John Quincy and then eventually Louisa to join John and Abigail. Louisa remains in the F Street home in Washington, but then will also suffer a stroke the year after John Quincy died. She'll be visited by dignitaries when they have a New Year's Day party in her final years, including both Presidents Zachary Taylor and Millard Fillmore, who will drop by. She'll finally die on May the 15th, 1852. Both houses of Congress will adjourn for the funeral, one of the first ever to be attended by a president and his entire cabinet, minus Daniel Webster. Louisa, like her husband, will be kept briefly at Congressional Cemetery, though she'll be kept in the Coston Vault, which we talked about with Dolly Madison. Charles Francis will prepare to move John Quincy into the church as Louisa's casket was being retrieved from the train station. Now, Louisa's casket will go in perfectly into the vault, but John Quincy's will prove to be too large, and the burial service has to be delayed so that masons could open the door wider to fit the giant casket. Across from where his plaque for his father rests in the sanctuary, John Quincy's will be written by Charles Francis. Quote, near this place reposes all that could die of John Quincy Adams, son of John and Abigail Adams, 6th President of the United States, born 11 June 1767. Amidst the storm of civil commotion, he nursed the vigor which serves a statesman and a patriot, and the faith which inspires a Christian. For more than half a century, whenever his country called for his labors, in either hemisphere or in any capacity, he never spared them in her cause. On the 24th of December 1814, he signed the second treaty with Great Britain, which restored peace within her borders. On the 23rd of February 1848, he closed 16 years of eloquent defense of the lessons of his youth by dying at his post in the Great National Council. A son worthy of his father, a citizen shedding glory on his country, a scholar ambitious to advance mankind, this Christian sought to walk humbly in the sight of his God. In 1927, a marble plaque was placed at the entrance to the tomb, reading John Quincy Adams, diplomat, senator, congressman, secretary of state, negotiator of peace treaty with England 1814, and 6th President of the United States 1767 to 1848. Louisa's will read Louisa Catherine Adams, frail of body, simple in taste, retiring in nature. She filled the onerous positions to which it pleased God to assign her with grace, dignity, and fortitude. Now, the spot where John Quincy Adams collapsed is now recognized in what's called Statuary Hall, where they have statues brought in from all around the country to decorate that room. But there's a plaque on the spot where he sat in the former House Chamber reading John Quincy Adams, Representative from Massachusetts, 1831 to 1848, desk location. Tour guides keep his legacy alive with what they call the Whisper Spot. The room where he died, the former Speaker's office, is now called the Lindy Claiborne Boggs Women's Congressional Reading Room. And while it is off limits, they do still have the couch that he expired on, as well as a bust of John Quincy Adams as a nod to his legacy there. If you go to Hancock Cemetery, you can view the vault where John Quincy Adams' name is still on it, as well as if you go to Washington's Congressional Cemetery, you can view the public vault where President Harrison and Taylor both were held, and then, as I said, after Adams, where First Lady Dolly Madison will be kept. There's also a cenotaph for John Quincy Adams there that reads, John Quincy Adams, a representative in the Congress of the United States from the state of Massachusetts, died 23 February 1848, age 79 years. And while that's a typo, you know, the thought was there. Now, if you want to go back and listen to season 3, episode 2 on John Adams's crypt, I talk about my experiences going there. And I'll touch on what I experienced there, but my first visit, you'll recall, had been in June of 2019 when I was making my way through the New England states. That's what I was really kind of focused on, was getting to visit these different presidential sites. And so never gone to the Adams sites before. So made a whole day of just setting it aside that I would want to be able to go through both the birthplace and the home, and then of course wind up at the grave site. And so it was at the end of that day, I'd gone to the birthplaces first, then the home, and then because it's not directly attached to the historical site, instead the church is operated privately, you know, you did want to make separate arrangements, but they were very, very good about facilitating like how to get there. And so I went across the street where I was able to get right in to go into first the sanctuary and then be able to go downstairs. Now, as I talked about in episode 2, my guide for this, I didn't know it at the time, was Kurt Dion. And so he gave us a kind of overview of the church itself and then the sanctuary as we were able to take photos and kind of process through, you know, those plaques that are at the front of the church. And then again, just take in the kind of majesty of that big sanctuary. Then we were led down into the crypt where you're going down the stairs and into this hallway where they have a gate over the door and then the four plaques for John, Abigail, John Quincy, in Louisa. And then after it was unlocked, we were able to go into that crypt itself. When you go in there, it's not all that visually stimulating, right? That's the four sarcophagi with the just their names on top, right? It just says John Adams, Abigail Adams, John Quincy Adams, Louisa Adams. And so there really isn't all too much in that spot to kind of take in. It's really everything in the sanctuary and then in that hallway where they try to make sense of John Quincy and John Adams's legacies, as well as their wives. And so that's, I think, something that was really striking. I mean, it really is just a sarcophagus. And I think you get the sense when you're in there that our being able to go inside wasn't always the feature. And that's something we'll explore throughout this season, is looking at the different presidents' resting places and how, because of our kind of more curious side in the 20th and 21st centuries, like we want to have that physical proximity. When I think for most people, you know, if you go to the Vatican, for instance, you don't get to wander around next to each sarcophagi, right? That's a more modern thing. They thought, like, as long as you can see the marker and the wonderful epitaph, like that's enough for most people. But again, we're going to take it a little bit further. And so that was definitely striking, right? When you're in there, it's, you know, they do have lights and stuff, but the feature really is just the prominence of the sarcophagi and then what's inside, what you know is inside in terms of their legacy. But right after that, then I was on my way. I went, I think that same day, to the Kennedy Presidential Center and other sites in New England from there. But I did make a return visit this time in the summer of 2022, where I wanted to go back. I had not taken a selfie with either gravesite. And then after having started the podcast, I knew there were other things I should be kind of watching out for. Now, as I mentioned in the episode 2, I did not make the proper arrangements to look at what days the church was going to be open. And so while I went through the birthplace and the home, I wasn't able to go to the gravesite that same day. And so luckily I was spending the night and went to Salem instead. But then the next day got up and was there right when they opened so I could go in and have enough time. And in this one, I remember it just being a lot more, I don't want to say lax, but they didn't have the same kind of time constraints. And it was really more us being able to ask questions if we wanted, but not there being like a complete narrative that went with the sanctuary or the crypt itself. And so I got the photos that I needed. Was really surprised on this visit that they had just had John Quincy's birthday. And so his presidential wreath was there. And so that's the photo that you're seeing on the website. But that was my visit on the second trip to John Quincy's gravesite along with his father's. Now, the thing that really strikes me after having done this episode and thinking a lot more about John Quincy is how much I think he's deserving of kind of his own commemorations, like aside from his father. I think in some ways it's like two birds with one stone. Like the fact that they're together is the awesome part of it. And I agree. Like it's awesome that you can see two presidents' birthplaces and the home has two presidents living there and the gravesite. You get both of them side by side. That's awesome. But what really is striking too is how on his own, if we're talking about John Quincy Adams removed completely from his father, which I know is really difficult. Like when we're in an age of talking about Nepo babies, like could there be anybody more clearly a Nepo baby in this early time where, you know, George Washington didn't have a son, Thomas Jefferson didn't have a son, and James Madison's was a ne'er-do-well stepson. But the idea that like they didn't have somebody that they could kind of position in this place. But what John Adams had in John Quincy was a startup kid himself, right? He didn't need anybody to kind of press down on the gas pedal. He had that engine for himself. Some of it derived from his parents for certain. But I think John Quincy always had a lot more going on in his mind. And I think when we're measuring just outright intelligence and brilliance, if I could, I think John Quincy's got to be top five at the least, but I'd argue maybe top three of our presidents. And in terms of preparation, you know, he has that resume. So like I was saying, if he wasn't John Adams' son, I think we'd be talking about somebody that would be in Statuary Hall by himself, that would have a gravesite by himself, right? That would be deserving of these memorials and monuments, and that it's only because they're paired together that in some ways they become this hydra that I think is easier to discount, interestingly enough. As I talked about in episode 2, you know, there is this effort underway in Washington to have a monument to the Adams family. And I always laugh thinking about, I'm not talking about the sitcom, but you know what I mean. The Adamses and the contributions of John, Abigail, John Quincy, and then get into Sam and Charles Francis and Henry. Like they did a lot. I think that they are deserving of that. And John Quincy, I think, is deserving of it on his own. When I look at the Statuary Hall representation from Massachusetts, you know, how would you not put John Quincy in there? I get having John Winthrop and I get Sam Adams, but I also think I would put both President Adamses in there. Right? Like I would put John and I'd put John Quincy and I'd argue for Abigail for a third, right? And so that's the thing that I think I'm most kind of caught off with John Quincy is it isn't just his lead up to the presidency, but it's the contributions post-presidency that I feel like we should be paying more attention to and definitely wrestling with a bit more than what we're seeing, I guess. And so that's something that is definitely striking to me. Now, there's nothing I would say to add to the gravesite. That is, I think, a wonderful way to have them preserved. And that it's interesting that it was John Quincy's interest in making his father's legacy elevated by burying him in a church. And that was something that was going to be an honor mainly in Europe, but he said, you know, my dad's deserving of it. And so how wonderful that Charles Francis had the foresight to say, like, I think my dad should be there too. And so that I think is a fitting end for both of them. But I do think there should be more. I'll just say that. I think there should be more. And I think you'll be struck by that too when you get into John Quincy Adams's life and the fact that we don't have too many places that are separate just for John Quincy. I can't think of any, right? Like even when it came to finding places that were named after John Quincy, they're all named Adams County, Ohio, for instance, or Adams County, Illinois. But we're unclear if it's for John or John Quincy. And that's the point, right? There are a couple places that were named Quincy for John Quincy, we think. And he does get his own recognition at University of Massachusetts. But that's kind of it. In terms of finding statues of him, you won't find too many. There's that bust of him, but it's in a room that most of us won't get to visit. So, you know, where is our tribute to John Quincy and the contributions that he made? That's the thing. So I guess I'll just leave it at that. But definitely something that is, you know, on my mind as I was reading more about John Quincy and his contributions, but all sorts of different places that you can go and find his legacy. Now, I have been to the Capitol building. I have been at the Whispering Spot, where the legend is that you can talk very quietly when you're at that spot, and that the sound will carry because of the acoustics of that room. So I've been there. I've not been to Congressional Cemetery. I've never been inside the Lindy Boggs Congressional Reading Room. So there are John Quincy spots that I can go to. But again, I just think that John Quincy's deserving of a bit more recognition. And I will not say this for every president, by the way. Don't think I'm going to be arguing for, a Millard Fillmore statue or anything like that. But John Quincy, I think, is deserving of it. So that's where we'll leave it for there. And when we come back, we'll be talking about a big reason why we don't have more John Quincy stuff, and that's his giant opponent, his giant tormentor, and Andrew Jackson, and his presidency, of course, the end of his term, but then his legacy post-presidency, I think, is something that we are going to really kind of wrestle with. And so you won't want to miss Andrew Jackson and his tomb at his home at the Hermitage. So make sure you come back in 2 weeks. Remember to check out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for Visiting the Presidents. Also, consider supporting Visiting the Presidents by writing a review or donating through PayPal. All season, I've been bringing you content from William D. Gregorio's complete book of U.S. Presidents, Louis Picone's The President is Dead, and I also highly recommend Brady Carlson's Dead Presidents. For John Quincy Adams, I recommend a book dedicated completely to John Quincy's post-presidency called Mr. Adams's Last Crusade, John Quincy Adams' Extraordinary Post-Presidential Life in Congress, James Traub's John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit, William J. Cooper's The Last Founding Father, John Quincy Adams and the Transformation of American Politics, Harlow Giles Unger's John Quincy Adams, and then Fred Kaplan's John Quincy Adams, American Visionary. All of these come highly recommended. They all kind of hit the same beats, but I found different things in each one, and I don't think I can get enough of his own writing, so there's that. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks when we go back to the Hermitage and Andrew Jackson's gravesite, and we'll wrestle with his legacy. So there's all sorts of fun to be had. Keep looking for these presidential sites and exploring them on your own. And as always, I look forward to seeing you out there on the road as we continue to visit the presidents. See ya.